The chair apologizes for her runny nose. She is accusing her committee administrator of passing hers along. So I will do the best I can. We're going to go ahead and get started. Hopefully we will get some other members, but we are going to be officially in subcommittee till we have a quorum. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 105 and Senate Bill 188 and ask Mr. Chamberlain and Mr. Delaney to come forward. And then as we go to other folks, we're going to just open a hearing on the entire plethora of bills that are here and just ask you to express your concerns, your frustrations, your whatever about what's happening, and we'll go from there. Mr. Chamberlain, welcome.
Good morning. Senator Browns and members of the committee, I'm going to speak first to Senate Bill 105. 105 is supported by the governor. It creates some of the unintended circumstances of the 2003 PERS reform, and it's focused on break in service. As you may remember, as defined by the 2003 PERS reform, when a Tier 1 or Tier 2 PERS member has a break in service of longer than 6 months, they default to the OPSERP program on their return to service. Senate Bill 105 establishes an exemption to the six-month timeline for two groups of employees. Those employees who were on leave as of August 28, 2003, such employees have been on leave, have to be leave authorized by law or the employer. And both the employer and the employee anticipate the person would return to employment at the completion of the leave. And those employees on receiving disability allowances, firefighters, other employees. And I'm going to turn it over to Steve Delaney.
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, for the record, Steve Delaney, Deputy Director of PERS. I actually have provided testimony there that can be handed out to the committee on Senate Bill 105 and 188. What I basically want to do is just explain briefly, because it impacts many other bills, not only these, but the ones that are coming, break in service, and what the issue is there with regard to break in service. The reform legislation in 2003 provided that if an individual was away from providing service to employer, that they were not providing service for 6 months or more, that upon return to employment or return to service, that individual would move from the PERS Tier 1, Tier 2 plan to the new Oregon Public Service Retirement Plan. Now, what I've provided to you in the Senate Bill 105 testimony is on the back is a two-page comparison of the plans. There's just a little matrix that runs along and shows you what Tier 1, Tier 2, and OPSERP provides. And what I like to point out is the issue that seems to be the biggest issue for individuals in moving from one plan to the other is the change in ages, that top line where you see retirement age running along. For Tier 1, it's age 58. For Tier 2, it's age 60. And for OPSERP, the Oregon Public Service Retirement Plan, it's 65. So that's one of the biggest concerns that members have as they move from one plan to another is the change in ages and what impact that has on them. And that explains the concern you have from a lot of members about the change. Again, Senate Bill 105 is making two basic changes to the current operation of break in service statutory directives. Section 1, as Tom indicated, provides that if you're on a PERS disability, be it duty or non-duty, that you would not incur break in service during that time period. Section 3 clarifies that if a person had started on approved leave prior to the passage of reform, that they would not incur break in service upon the return. These particular concepts, those in Senate Bill 105, were vetted through the PERS Board's Legislative Advisory Committee. We did have a lot of discussion. There was general consensus, but the PERS Board did not introduce these bills at the time. They were considered an issue of benefits. It does impact benefits, and so they left that to the legislature's discretion to make that decision. Then my only other testimony is regarding Senate Bill 188. Again, dealing with the break in service issue, this one's trying to deal with the issue of people that are seasonal employees. A part-time employee can get PERS coverage if you work more than 6 months so that you establish PERS membership and in a calendar year work 600 hours. So we have part-timers that through the years have established PERS and they return, especially if they're seasonals, they return every year, but there can be occasions when the season's shorter and they don't have 6 months in a row to work. They may actually have a seven-month break, and so these people would be moved from Tier 1, Tier 2 into the new plan simply because that seasonal nature and variance in their work. This bill is saying, Senate Bill 188, is saying that that seasonal nature would not incur a break in service.
Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate you being here this morning. Next up, I'm going to call Jim Green, Beth Ann Darley, and Sandy Ellis. And if you wish, we could have you. In fact, I'm going to open a public hearings on Senate Bill 105, Senate Bill 188, Senate Bill 1019, Senate Bill 1020, Senate Bill 1021, Senate Bill 1022, Senate Bill 1023, and Senate Bill 1024. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Jim Green with the Oregon School Boards Association. I guess we'll take them in order.
Great.
Senate Bill 105 is a bill that I believe that the public employees, the PERS Coalition, the public employers do agree upon. It's an issue that needs to be taken care of with regard to break-in service. And for those employees who inadvertently got caught due to the date of enactment of the legislation from last session, there is some concern, however, in the bill, and we're working with the public employees the PERS Coalition, to try to amend this bill, because the way it's written right now, it deals with a written agreement between the employer and employee, and we may have some employees who didn't take that leave under a written agreement, but some sort of other agreement between the employer and employee. We are going to sit down with the PERS Coalition folks within the next week or so to try to come up with language that can make this work for everybody concerned. But we understand the concept, we understand the idea, and we want to fix that for those employees. On 188, the Dash 1 amendments, I believe, take care of concerns from the League of Oregon Cities. Michelle Dyster may speak to those, but I believe the Dash 1s take care of that. And it kind of really limits it to two groups of folks, is my understanding. They work as firefighters for the Department of Forestry. They come in every year and fight the fire season, and then they are on break because in the wintertime the fire season isn't there. The other group is with the Park and Rec Department, those folks that are seasonal during the times when those parks are open, and then again during the winter months they shut down. My understanding is that the Dash 1s do take care of the concerns from the League of Oregon Cities, so we would support 188 with the Dash 1 amendments.
Okay. Thank you.
The rest of the package of bills we do have some concerns about, and I could go into specifics on each one of those if you want me to, but we have sat down and I've talked to Beth Ann Darby with a representative of the PERS Coalition. We plan to meet right now on the 26th of this month around 3 o'clock in the afternoon. We're trying to find a room to sit down and talk about the issues in each one of these bills that public employers have concerns about but would also support. And I think you may hear some testimony from Beth Ann and the other folks in the PERS Coalition as to why they need some of these bills. But employers have concerns over some of the provisions in the bills because we went through a very tumultuous session last session dealing with PERS. You all know that. And we believe that some of the provisions in the bill will raise cost and change the system dramatically. And we want to sit down with the PERS Coalition, talk about those. And the concerns that we have, really, if you take a look at the folks I represent, which are the K-12 school districts and education service districts, their rates in the next 4 years are expected to double, go from 11% to 22% of payroll. And we want to sit down with PERS and the PERS Coalition and take a look at the provisions of the bills, what cost implications may be there. There are some bills that we may not get there, but I think there's some of these provisions in some of the bills that we can sit down with the folks across the aisle and figure out what we need.
Great. Well, if you folks need a room, I'm sure I can help provide one.
We were counting on it for a
Thank you, Mr. Green.
Thank you.
Ms. Beth Ann Darby.
Senator Brown, my name is Beth Ann Darby, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Education Association, and the OEA participates in the PERS Coalition, which is the labor organizations that represent public employees. I generally agree with the statements made by Jim Green. Our package here is really around what we understood to be mostly consensual issues around unintended, what we perceived as unintended consequences around a fairly finite group of people. We've since learned that we perhaps were mistaken, and we look forward to these discussions with the employee representatives to see if we can work out some of these kinks. But we had spent time in the PERS Legislative Advisory Committee over the last 2 years, and we really did think prior to this week that most of these ideas may need some technical tinkering, but we're generally okay. The primary concern around from the PERS Coalition really focuses on the issues of moving PERS members, Tier 1 and Tier 2 members, to the new retirement system. And that is really the shorthand that we all use is break in service. Senate Bill 105 is a good start, but it really doesn't go far enough because it assumes that public employees had notice and an opportunity to come to that sort of an agreement with their employer. We appreciate where it starts because certainly there are some collective bargaining agreements that I think would follow, you know, would meet that definition, but there were a lot of folks that generally speaking thought they had approximately 5 years to retain their status as a Tier 1 or Tier 2 member and were out on leave, didn't have notes that this bill was going to happen, had already exceeded 6 months or the 12-month mark. Affects a lot of women who involving family planning. Those are primarily my members that I've heard from around this issue and were summarily bumped into the new retirement system. And so we introduced Senate Bill 1019 to address some of those issues. Our proposal was to give folks a window of time, essentially from the implementation date of the original legislation through August 28, 2005 of this year, with the thinking that when this bill passes, folks will have 60 to 90 days to get their affairs in order, decide whether they want to return to public employment and retain their Tier 1 or Tier 2 status. We understand that our proposal may go further than that, and we are open to working with employers to see if we can find some mutually agreed upon language to fix the retroactivity angle of this. The other issue that is very important to OEA members, and you'll hear from AFT as well, has to do with issues around community colleges and part-time faculty. Senate Bill I also want to mention Senate Bill 1023 in regard to the break-in service issue. Senate Bill 1023, we understand, is not supported generally by the employer coalition, although there are employers who do feel that it's a responsible proposal and allows for local control of break-in service issues. And what it does is it creates a mutual consent option. So where there is a policy or collective bargaining agreement that allows this sort of thing, and then one more time, the employer and the specific employee reach agreement about when the employee would be returning to work, then they can agree on a different length of time. And what this would do is it would allow public employees who may have a religious background that, in the case of folks of the Mormon faith, they go on two-year missions. This would allow them to do that without jeopardizing their status as a Tier 1, Tier 2 person, having to make that difficult decision. It would also allow for some other kinds of life choices that we just can't anticipate. I have some members with family leave issues who went out for their a good example that I think has been well publicized is a woman from this area who went out to have a baby and found out that she had her own health need that required the duration of her 12 consecutive months. At the end of that time, her employer came to her and said, "You really haven't had time with your child the way you anticipated. You've been here a while. You're valuable to us. Would you like to have another year of unpaid leave and then come back? And we will give you a position at the end of that second year." And she took that right around the time that this bill, that OPSERP passed, and she suddenly is being bumped into the new retirement program. The mutual consent option allows local employers to have local control over the break in service issue, and we think it's a responsible option to give some flexibility. And then the final piece I want to just touch on, and other coalition members will talk about other aspects of this package, is around community college faculty. And really, the bottom line here is that under PERS, there was a statute, ORS 238.074, that said that for community college faculty, if you worked a 0.5 FTE or a 0.375, depending on whether you were quarters or semesters, that equated to 600 hours of service. And that 600 hours of service under PERS is worth 1 year of service credit. We fast forward to OPSERP, where there is no language like that. Community college faculty are not hired based on hours of service, and we have no formula for making that conversion. Each school does it, under current law, is allowed to figure out a formula independently. This causes all sorts of problems because it doesn't really allow community college members to know whether they have been able to put together work for a public pension. A straight hour per hour worth of service doesn't account for all of the unknowns, the time with students, the grading papers, and the other things that full-time faculty get credit for. Also, for community college faculty, the language under OPSERP, you could be a Tier 1 or Tier 2 member, have this because you're a 0.5 FTE, 0.375 FTE, but it doesn't convert to 600 hours of service, and so you have nowhere to deposit your 6% employee contribution because you don't qualify for OPSERP even though you're a PERS Tier 1 or Tier 2 member. Included with my testimony is a brief outline of the statutes and how they relate to OPSERP and PERS. Senate Bill 1021 is really our effort to address the questions that have come up around how these two programs work together and the unintended consequences that we believe part-time community college faculty are facing. And with me is Sandy Ellis, and she's here to talk about break-in-service issues and how they impact some of the OEA members that she represents. And I thought she was a wonderful person to have with us because she really represents a wide variety of both certified and classified school employees.
Ms. Ellis, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you.
Senator Brown and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sandy Ellis, and I live at 2018 Northwest Fairbank Place in Albany, Oregon. And as Bethann said, I'm here to kind of tell you a little bit of a story, because after you legislated all the PERS changes last time, it fell on me to see how it affected my members and work with my members. I represent about 2,000 teachers and classified employees in the Mid-Valley region for OEA. I have some very strong feelings about what happened to employees' retirement when they needed to take a leave of absence from work. When we were first notified about the changes that were legislated, the first thing I did was ask my districts. I work with 7 districts in the Mid-Valley area, and I asked my districts to provide me with a list of our members who are currently out on leave. I asked for the reasons for the leave and the length of the leave. I had people who were out for medical reasons. I had folks who were gone because they needed to follow their husband's career paths for a while. I also had members who were gone just to take a break and get re-energized to come back, because 30 years can be a long time without a break. And 30 years is also a long time for nothing to go wrong in your life, where you need to go take care of something else and then come back to do a better job. I talked to most of the people on the list, and some came back within your timelines, and some were already gone too long, and some actually, because of that, decided not to return to Oregon. Others returned to have their retirement reduced, and then life went on, and I felt a lot of anger for the treatment of these people, it seems, in such a cavalier manner. But I did as much damage control out in the field as I possibly could, And then I began to watch and warn other people who needed leaves of absences about the possible punitive results of taking leaves. After a few months, the damage to people's lives that this piece of legislation was going to level became even clearer to me. There's a group of people who work for school districts that you don't hear much about. You hear a lot about the teachers, but these people keep the schools clean. They transport students to school. They feed thousands of students their breakfast and lunch each day. They care for special needs students. They support teachers with student instruction. And they do many, many other things, too, to keep the schools open in an environment that's conducive to learning. So one day, a special education assistant came into my office, a classified member. She had worked for the district for 19 years. Her doctor said she had to have surgery, and we applied for the leave. The personnel director wrote her a letter that said she was sorry, but she was ineligible for FMLA or OFLA because she doesn't work enough hours in the day. And so it would have to be an unpaid leave of absence, and she would have to pay for her own insurance. But the leave, this kind of leave, is available through her contract, and so she prepared to do that. It was going to be a very complicated surgery, and she was going to have to stay off of work for months. And I asked how many months, and I was told that she would not be back within 6 months. So here I had a teacher's assistant who had worked for the same district for 19 years, and I had to tell her, because she's sick and needed surgery, that the last one-third of her career will be with a lesser retirement program. We have a lot of stories like this. School bus drivers, school food service workers, instructional assistants, these folks work for many years in the public schools serving our students. And if they become sick, or if they need to stay home with a child for a while, or if they have family or personal matters they need to attend to any time within those 30 years, all they get is 6 months to fix their lives, or they'll suffer under this punitive measure and lose retirement benefits as well. They often don't work enough hours to qualify for your 12-month provision. And I don't think it's right, and I don't think it's fair. I appreciate that you're reviewing the statute, and I ask you to please look at the equity and fairness issues that I've raised today. I know it isn't exactly in focus with the Senate bills that are before you, but I encourage you to retroactively help as many people as you can. But I also ask you to take away the FMLA and the OFLA qualification requirement and give everyone at least 12 months opportunity to take care of their personal life problems. When they're given time to fix their problems and take care of their health, they return as much more productive employees, and of course that's better for our schools and our students. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much. Ms. Darby and Mr. Green, we are obviously hoping to try and close down session in a reasonable period of time. So I would just encourage you to get together quickly, and if you need either staffing assistance or room assistance, please let us know. But we need results, and we need them quickly.
And Madam Chair, we understand that. With regard to 105 and the break-in service issues that are contained in there and some of the other bills, there has been litigation filed, and our members have been sued, and they're trying to defend those actions. We want to try to limit and eliminate a lot of those cases by legislation that would be contained in 105. We understand the need for a timely rectification of this, and we want to work with the PERS Coalition to try to get our hands around it, and also work with them on which of those cases could be dismissed by what legislation may come through this body.
Great. Thank you all very much. Next up, did Mary Bodkin come back? Pat West. Tricia Smith. And when Mary comes back, we'll... Good morning and welcome.
Good morning. You want me to start? Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Pat West. I'm president of the Oregon State Firefighters Council. Represent the firefighters in the state of Oregon. Let me clarify that, the paid firefighters in the state of Oregon. I do not represent volunteer firefighters. So these issues that we're talking about deal with my members. In order to kind of synopsize, I would like you, one, to know that I agree with everything that was said previously by Beth Ann, so I don't want to try and cover the very same material. We do feel that that 105 is a good bill, but we don't think it goes far enough. We need the issues that are covered in 1019 as well as the situation in 105. And in fact, in our opinion, the situation for the people in 1019 only dealing with people that have actual duty-related disability creates a hardship as well. The reason being that firefighters, if they get injured off-duty, they can have a lot longer recovery period than other workers, and the reason being when they come back to work, they have to be able to work at 100%. There's no in between. So if they have a blown knee, for example, off the job, they cannot come back to work wearing a brace or hobbling. They have to be able to climb a ladder and do all the physical agility situations that a firefighter does. So we actually would love to have the bill cover people with off the job injuries as well. There is also an issue that wasn't discussed dealing with the Senate Bill 1022. Now, 1022 deals with issues that have to do with death benefits and a delay in payment for death benefits, and also the possibility of low death benefits for Tier 1 and Tier 2. And the reason it's really easy to describe this, and that is that death benefits for Tier 1 and Tier 2 members are based solely on their account balance. So if a member dies while employed, they get twice their account balance. Well, with the changes that were made last session, especially members of Tier 1 or Tier 2 that have only been employed for a few years, their account balances are not very large. The intent of the way it was set up was so that as employees work more and more years, their account balance grows and their death benefit would be higher. With the situation where the money now goes over into the IAP, the death benefit will not increase in the same fashion that it did prior to the legislation in 2003. So I think that's a very crucial part of this package to get that corrected. And then we're also in favor of the situation where we would have the voluntary program where employers and employees could agree for an extended leave, so that if firefighters, for example, were to go with Northwest Medical Teams to a foreign country and work for a tsunami relief or whatever the situation is, that they would in fact not lose their Tier 1 or Tier 2 retirement upon return. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. West. Ms. Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association, and I will be as brief as possible, Madam Chair. I am here particularly to talk about the break in service bills as they affect my members who are predominantly classified part-time school employees but also certified teachers in ESDs. I would urge you to please look carefully at the PERS Coalition's handout to you that describes the bills, because it does a very good job of describing the provisions of Senate Bill 1019, particularly, as well as Senate Bill 1023. You've heard universal support for Senate Bill 105 as far as it goes, and I'm hoping that you will apply a reasonable test to the rest of the provisions, because we believe these are very reasonable for employers and employees. You've heard from Mr. Green there is a concern about increasing the cost of the system. I would suggest to you that these do not increase the cost of the system. These people exist now. They are PERS members. They have had these rights forever. It was a cost of the system always, and they are being punished in this decrease of the cost of the system by taking away their right to a reasonable break in service for either an unforeseen accident or disability or a foreseen and desired break for whatever reason, whether it be religious or, as Mr. West said, volunteering to help in emergency relief overseas, whatever the reason. If an employer and an employee believe that a break is reasonable, why would that not be appropriate, and why would we say no and prevent these people from doing what's right for them, what's right for their families, or what's right for all of us by taking this break? We believe that those are reasonable exceptions to the intent of this bill. We don't believe the intent should have been, if it was, to punish PERS members because they get sick or they're injured. I think I'm a fairly good example of a motivated employee, and I had an 8-month disability that was non-duty related in 2000, and I couldn't have come back to work a day sooner. If I were a PERS employee working for a public employer, and this law was the law at that time, I would have not only dealt with the disability and the trauma to myself and my family that that caused, but I would have lost a significant portion of my pension benefits and my ability to raise a reasonable pension for my retirement. That's unreasonable. And I hope you'll apply the reasonable test to these bills when you're considering whether or not the provisions are appropriate. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Bodkin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Mary Bodkin, and I'm here today representing the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. And I'm going to be even briefer. I agree with everything everybody has said. I want to underscore 2 points. One is the need for many professional classes to have a break in service in order to expand their career opportunities or to continue with ongoing education that is required to do their jobs. We represent a wide, diverse group of individuals, including in one location, scientists, and there are times when scientists really do need to leave. Now, in the future, I believe we can work with the employer, notification and the written agreements. I think we can do all that. What is hard for me to capture is how many are being caught up in the net that they didn't know they needed to have a written agreement. So I really would encourage you to sort of go back, take a look at that, and let's fix that, and we're willing to work with Mr. Green and the employers to do that. The other piece I want to mention and underscore is the life, the death benefits and the fact that the IEP now draws down that benefit. We just got current life expectancy rates for our Department of Corrections employees, and corrections officers have a life expectancy rate of 59 years, and that is significantly less than what we have seen in the past. And so we have a real serious concern that the kind of drawing down of their death benefits is going to have a tremendous impact on the family that is left behind. So, we would really encourage you to take a look at that.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel? Senator Ringo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for testifying. Just a couple questions. I am concerned about the cost of PERS. To me, the break in service really is about being fair to the employees, though. I mean, to me, it makes complete sense. I'm wondering whether this was part of the debate in 2003. Because frankly, I stayed out a lot of the PERS battles, thankfully. But was this part of the discussion when we passed the package of bills last session?
Yes. Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, we certainly brought this issue up and objected to it at that time.
I see.
Madam Chair, Senator Ringo. Also, though, there was more consequences than we realized, even in the discussions. Because it was such sweeping changes, the example of the death benefits, I don't think any of us realized the total impact that it was going to have on death benefits. And certainly on the vacant service generally. I mean, we were wrestling with it, trying to figure out, you know, how to deal with it. And we've had a lot more instances and a lot more people impacted than we realized in the discussions in 2003.
I see. Just to follow up, Madam Chair.
Senator Ringo.
Before our bill last session, the package of bills, was there a break in service issue that would affect somebody that was subject to Tier 1 and might push them into Tier 2 if there was a break in service? Trisha's shaking.
Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, I believe that per statute said you could be gone for 5 years and return to your status.
I see. Okay.
Well, and there was no move sort of from Tier 1 to Tier 2 to OPSERP.
Right.
You know, you were like in Tier 1 to OPSERP.
Yeah.
And so, you know, this is, and, you know, we raised issues. I know the firefighters and AFSCME both raised the issue about folks who were injured on the job. We were assured that was taken care of. You know, it may be, it may not be. It's like the total temporary, or the temporary total disability. What we want to be sure is that folks who leave in good faith,
that's right,
with every intention of coming back and have the opportunity to do so. I am concerned about some kind of artificial deadlines when public employment is shrinking, it is not growing, and expecting people to come back and find a public service job that will re-qualify them for PERS if there's no job available. And that's probably a bigger concern for our lower end, I don't want to say lower end, our lesser paid employees and members.
Yeah, thank you.
Senator Ringo.
I just was not able to follow you on a death benefit issue. I apologize for that. But it sounds like that if you're in Tier 1 or Tier 2, there's a declining IAP, so you have a declining death benefit. Is that right?
Your account balance grows slower because you're now...
Madam Chair, Senator Ringo.
Okay.
Your death benefit is solely calculated on your account balance in Tier 1 or Tier 2, the employee account balance. So if when you, in 2003, if you had $10,000 in your account and you were a 10-year member, then it's not going to grow, and you're not going to have contributions going into it. It's going over to the IAP. So since the death benefit specifically says it's based solely on this amount that's in your employee account on this side, and the intention of the death benefit was to grow as the number of years you worked, and plus it's your contributions that are going in there that it's being based on, and then it's matched by the employer. That's the death benefit package.
So, go ahead. I'm sorry.
We're suggesting that the money in the IAP should be added to what, for death benefit calculations only, I mean, these type of scenarios, would be added to it so that it would be the same as it was before last session.
Okay.
The two would add together, and you would end up with the same amount of death benefit that you had for Tier 1 and Tier 2 members prior to 2003.
Okay. Thank you.
Anything further, Senator Ringo?
Mr. West, Ms. Bodkin, the reason I'm going to go to you is be evident, but I feel very comfortable dealing with the break in service issue for people who have health issues, on-the-job injuries, family leave, et cetera. I think what I'm troubled by is the voluntary break, and I guess what I want to hear from your perspective and your perspective, Ms. Bodkin, in terms of corrections, about why when someone's a corrections officer in a penal institution for 30 years, why it's important for them possibly to take a break, mental health break or whatever, you know, why we should allow them to do that.
If I worked in a correctional facility, I'd take it a long time before 30 years. The mental health break, that is. I think it's important to understand that the folks who work in sort of public safety and the higher professional classes generally have a very strong public commitment to other programs that serve the community. A lot of those folks are members of search and rescue teams. Just by virtue of the physical condition that they have to be in to do their normal jobs makes them also good candidates for those positions within their community that require that they do that would require that they do other similar type duties. Those folks oftentimes are the folks who also volunteer, as Mr. West indicated, and he can speak for himself obviously, but that also volunteer to go to earthquake victims, tsunami victims, you know, who have done the kind of service that requires that they take a break in service, and at times it can exceed the 6-month limitation, and they may or may not have gotten a written agreement with their employer before they left. And so that is, I mean, that's our biggest concern. And then with the ongoing education piece, Madam Chair, you know, many of you on this committee understand that there's an ongoing educational requirement for some professions, but there's also some interest. I mean, we represent people who get who have a salary schedule that's based on how many times they've been published. You know, I can't even imagine being in that kind of a category, but we do represent some of those people. And it does require that they go out for extensive educational enhancements. Okay. Again, in the future, we can take care of them, but I don't know how many we've lost sort of between the cracks in the past.
Mr. West, any further comments?
Yeah, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Our job as firefighters and paramedics, it parallels so much the type of issues that we deal with on the job are the same types that they need when you have a major situation. Whether it's in the United States and it's a terrorist activity, we now have teams that go across state lines, and if we have a major situation in another state, there are members of fire departments in Oregon that would be leaving and going to those states to function. Now, I don't know how large of a situation it would be to cause people to be gone more than 6 months, but we certainly could have that happen. But the same situation applies when we're talking about, again, Northwest medical teams. We're paramedics, we're firefighters, we deal with high angle rescue, with trench rescue, all the things that are the requirements of people to go and assist in national disasters around the world. So that's what we have a natural inclination as firefighters to help people, and then you also have the ability and training to do what needs to be done in these situations. So we have a higher number of people that end up going and doing things with Northwest medical teams, or, and I keep using that, but with our search and rescue teams and all different situations.
Well, and Mr. West, you had members who went to help in New York
exactly.
for September 11th, and I think that's a really good example. Okay.
Exactly.
Any further questions for this panel? Senator Shields and Senator Lingo.
Just a quick one, and I know the answer is anecdotal, but how common is this verbal agreement versus written agreements when it comes to this stuff?
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, yeah, I think that in some cases they're pretty common. I mean, I think people sit down with their employer and say, you know, this is what, you know, they've got this, you know, we have an issue, you know, we have the tsunami. I mean, we had nurses who went to tsunami, to the Asian, anyway. So they sit down and they say, you know, can you do without me for, you know, a couple of weeks? I'm going to go over and help. I'm going to sign up. And the employer looks at the schedule and they just don't get scheduled. I mean, they just work around the schedule and they're gone. And, you know, sometimes a couple of weeks stretches out and we just don't know. And it is anecdotal. we don't know how many people have been lost between the cracks because we don't know until they get back.
Senator Ringo, I'm sorry.
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, can I say that it depends on the type of leave and the type of employee in some cases? If the leave is for an illness, there may not be any written agreement at all. The person goes out and they're out till they come back. If it is for a voluntary religious mission, there may very well be a written agreement. Depends.
And Madam Chair, can I just say, it was one of our Mormon members who brought some of this to my attention. So,
thank you. Senator Ringo, one last question.
Just a couple comments. I think people ought to be allowed to have a break in service for any reason, even if it's to lay on a beach in Maui for a couple of years. I don't think they should jeopardize their rights in retirement. So I don't have any problem with that. I do, though, have a somewhat of an issue on the death benefits, and maybe that's something to talk about separately. It seems to me that death benefits are to care for the person's beneficiaries. It's not necessarily support, but the funds are to help care for the beneficiaries. And I don't think there's necessarily a correlation to what that need is to the length of service. And I know that all your analysis is predicated on, well, the death benefit ought to grow with the person's time in service. And I'm not sure I buy that assumption. Just a comment.
Okay. Thank you. We'll have some further discussion. You want to respond, Mr.
Madam Chair, if I could. I didn't agree with that concept, Senator. That's the concept that was in Tier 1 and Tier 2 for death benefits. I mean, that's how it was done. So the fact of the matter is the people that unfortunately pass away early in life have little or no death benefit under Tier 1 and Tier 2, but it's been reduced now. It really was not a good way to set up a death benefit, but that's what it was, and now it's been reduced.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, there are also a couple of other provisions in that bill that are important. One of them, the way if you don't pass that bill, Senate Bill 1022 or something with this provision in it, when a person dies, their spouse under the current law must wait until the dead spouse's retirement age before they collect the death benefit. And so
that doesn't help too much.
Doesn't seem to be the point.
No.
Thank you all very much.
Thank
we
you.
Appreciate you being here this morning. Next up, I have Ken Cropper and Mason Young. And on deck, I'd have Rob Wagner, Ross Fulberg, and Marilyn Pitts. Good morning and welcome to the Capitol this morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Madam Chair Brown, I'm Ken Cropper, and this is Mason Young. I brought with me, he is a former Portland Public School custodian. I represented SEIU School Employees Local 140 when the custodians were displaced in July 8, 2002. What happened is 318 people were out on the job market all at the same time in a very difficult climate. At the time, I believe unemployment was 8.2%. You know, so many people took a good deal of time to find employment. Some people found employment prior to August 28, 2003, when the six-month break in service went into effect. But many, including Mason here, did not. So they came back in under the new Oregon Public Service Retirement Plan. And I feel that they've been harmed. So what I did is I asked a few custodians to come. Mason was able to get the time off today, but there's three other people that were not able to come, but they did write statements, and I'd like to have those read into the record. The first one is Tina Jackie. She was with the district for 14 years. The next one's Dave Schleiger. He was with the district for 11 years, and finally Mark Schnorr, he was a head custodian, and he had worked for the Portland Public School District for 19 years.
Thank you. We'll take copies of those. Do you have copies of the letters?
I do have copies.
Okay.
I've got 10 copies.
Provide them to committee assistant and make them part of the record.
Okay. In addition, there's an article that was written in the Statesman Journal, I believe it's March 21st, 2004, by Steve Law, that addresses this issue of displacement and how it affected the Portland Public School custodians and their Tier 1 PERS.
Great.
So I'd like to introduce that into the record as well.
We'll make those all part of the written record.
So with any further ado, I'd like to introduce Mason Young.
Mr. Young, welcome.
Hello. I am Mason Young. I was a civil service public employee for Portland Public Schools for 16 years as a custodian. I was a Tier 1 employee since 86. In August 2002, my job was outsourced and was out of work for 15 months along with 318 other custodians. In 2002, during the layoff, the unemployment rate was at an all-time high of over 8%. And even having notice of the six-month break in service, it was hard to find a PERS job with the unemployment rate being so high. In December 2003, I found employment at the Beaverton School District, where I'm presently working now, but the break in service has affected me drastically. It appears I will have to work a minimum of 4 to 5 years under the new system, or 9 years if age 62. This is all under no fault of my own, being I was wrongfully eliminated. I would like the six-month break in service moved back to the 5 years break in service.
Thank you very much. Any questions for this panel? Thank you. We appreciate you joining us today.
Thank
you. Mr. Crapper?
One final comment. I think it's important going forward that you pay attention to people that lose their jobs or have an extended layoff through no fault of their own. Right now I hear that the Hillsborough School District is talking about eliminating their night custodians, and we have former members that are working in Hillsborough now, so that concerns me.
Well, Mr. Crapper, I think given the numbers that I've seen in terms of reserves that some of the school districts are sitting on, I think local communities are going to start to really question what's happening in terms of layoffs, classroom size, and that sort of thing. So that's not a conversation we're going to have with Hillsborough, but it's probably a conversation we're going to have with a number of the school districts across the state. So okay. I appreciate your comments.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And if you would provide our committee assistant with copies of the letters, we'll get those out to everyone.
Thank you.
So thank you. Okay. Thank you. That's my work. I'm only thinking today. Next up, Rob Wagner, Ross Fulberg, and Marilyn Pitts.
Good morning, Chair Brown.
Good morning.
Sorry, Barry Olley. Looks like we lost some committee members. My name is Rob Wagner. I'm the Political and Legislative Affairs Director for AFT Oregon. At Oregon's community colleges, our members work in faculty and classified positions at Oregon Coast, Southwestern Oregon, Columbia Gorge, and Lane Community College and Portland Community College. I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 1021, and this bill attempts to address a serious flaw in the treatment of part-time faculty at Oregon's community colleges who are currently not receiving retirement benefits under the Oregon Public Service Retirement Plan, or OPSERP. Just to respond a little bit to Senator Rigo's questions about the testimony around PERS and some of the debate on the floor. If you remember, OPSERP is the hybrid plan that passed last legislative session on the last day.
Mr. Wagner,
yes.
I actually need to stop you. We are losing our quorum, and we have to do some bill introductions and drafting requests. I'm sorry not to be concerned about you, but are either the two of you or anyone else in the audience who's wishing to testify under really extreme time pressures?
How far is extreme?
Like 3 minutes. It'll take us 3 minutes.
No,
okay.
Possibly.
All right. Thanks. That's extreme. Like you have to be in Portland in, an hour or something. Okay. So we're going to close the public hearings on the plethora of bills we were hearing. Chair's going to open a work session on bill drafting requests and introductions of LC drafts. The chair would move the following requests for drafting by legislative council and introduction as committee bills. Number one, from Senator Przyjanski, a bill relating to security of personal information. Number two, from Senator Przyjanski, a bill relating to social security numbers. Any discussions about those two? Any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. The chair would move the following LC drafts for introduction as committee members. LC 3521, allowing the Secretary of State to establish a pilot program to allow voters with disabilities to vote by telephone in some elections. LC 3527 creates authority for establishing a multidisciplinary team to study domestic fatalities. LC 3528 urges Congress to pass Employee Free Choice Act to protect and preserve for American workers freedom to form or join unions. And LC 3531 from Representative Dinkfelter establishes Ending Homelessness Advisory Council, appropriates money. Again, your vote in the introduction is not a vote in favor or opposition to the substance of the measures, and I can guarantee you that your vote will not delay the end of session. Any discussion on the LC requests? Hearing and seeing none, is there any opposition to the motion? Seeing none, so ordered. Thank you very much, Senator Ringo. Mr. Wagner, please proceed, and again, my apologies.
As Senator Ringo steps out, too, I just want to see perhaps Ross Holberg, who is from his district, we might be able to touch base with you about this legislation later. I know you've got a lot of bills up.
I have a meeting right now, but I'd be happy to talk.
That'll probably be the next Neighborhood Association president.
Okay. All right, take it away,
okay,
Mr. Wagner.
So, OPSERP, I actually geeked out over the last couple days and went back and listened to the committee testimony around House Bill 2020 from the last legislature.
Mr. Wagner, with no offense, I believe it's fairly easy for you to geek out.
Yeah. Well, you know,
he supports teachers.
I used to be on a certain chair staff, so I'll let that one go. Let's see. But around the testimony around this bill, it was really interesting because, you know, OPSERP, everyone agreed to, is much less expensive. It's a lot more stable. But in all the testimony around House Bill 2028 from last session, it was stated that the intention was not to deny any class of employee access to a retirement benefit plan that they would have received under PERS. Yes, a different plan, but not an entire group of folks that are receiving benefits under Tier 1 and Tier 2. Now, unfortunately, the language in PERS, which established the FTE standard as the basis for qualifying for retirement benefits for community college faculty, was not carried over into the new plan. Beth Ann Darby from OEA made mention of this, and it's actually on the first page of my testimony. There's the ORS on this. Now, the effect of this omission has actually led to part-time faculty who teach side-by-side, matching credit hours with identical classes and teaching assignments being treated drastically different from other part-time faculty hired before August 29, 2003. It has been difficult for us to obtain the community college policies regarding PERS and OPSERP. Originally, when I began inquiring into this issue last fall, I was told repeatedly that community colleges were treating part-time faculty similarly, whether they fell under PERS or OPSERP. And attached to my testimony is a statement from one of our members at PCC, David Reeves, who has inquired into the OPSERP policy at his college and has been met with a reply from the college, which is at a minimum exceedingly unclear, if not outright evasive. Through his own survey to faculty at PCC, he's discovered that it appears the college is not only denying retirement benefits to part-time faculty who would have qualified under PERS, but in many cases, part-time instructors who are teaching near full-time loads or better than full-time loads are being denied retirement benefits altogether. It is important to note that the term part-time instructor or faculty member is often a misnomer. A full teaching load for a full-time faculty member is defined as 45 credit hours a year at PCC, or teaching 5 3 credit hour classes over a calendar year. Outside of class, faculty keep office hours, they prepare course material, they evaluate work by students, they develop courses, and have other academic committee requirements for their departments. In testimony yesterday in the Ways and Means Committee, Cam Prost-Browley from the CCWD, Community College and Workforce Development Department, stated that 45 credit hours is considered one student FTE, or the equivalent of 510 clock hours. Put that in your brain, 510. Part-time faculty have great demands outside of class, which include meeting with students, grading material, and prepping coursework. Yet in a report submitted to PERS, it appears that the employers are only reporting the quote-unquote clock hours in the classroom for determining the basis for qualifying for retirement benefits. Now, Senator Brown, I know you taught at PSU. You certainly if you limited the work that you did in course preparation to the hours that you had in the class. So,
Mr. Wagner, I guess I'm curious what, and maybe you don't have it broken out on a salary scale, but I'd just be curious as to what the community colleges pay part-time faculty. And
Mr. Fulbright actually will address the difference in wages as well. But and actually, that's a good lead in. Today you'll hear from Ross Fulbright, who taught over 40 credit hours last year, over four terms in the math department at PCC, and he has not received any service credit toward an OPSERP retirement benefit. In the case of David Reese previously mentioned, he taught 48 credit hours last year. Yet under the college's treatment of part-time faculty, had he been hired after August 29th, he would not have received any service credit toward his retirement. Community college administrators may testify today about their inability to use FTE or take into account hours of work outside the classroom, since the statutory language under OPSERP is silent. However, we actually have examples of a very fair practice in the treatment of adjunct faculty at our OUS institutions, Oregon University System, under the same OPSERP statutory language found in Chapter 238A. I actually referenced this. It's Attachment 3, and it shows that for PSU, they just take the credit hours and then make it this many. You teach this many credit hours, it equals this many hours of service credit toward your retirement. This is basically the work assumption. For every one credit hour of course instruction equals 11.55 hours a month towards service credit for either PERS or OPSERP. This type of standard is simple, it's efficient, it's easy to understand, and it's fair. You also may hear from administrators today about the need for local control to determine retirement benefit eligibility. I would just remind the committee that OPSERP is a retirement plan which extends to all sorts of public employees, from administrators to firefighters to public health nurses, many of whose local governments receive little or no general fund support. However, the OPSERP statute governs these employees' eligibility and their accrual and service credit with clarity and fairness. And I just actually attached the language about service accrual under OPSERP, too. In contrast, community colleges currently receive over 40% of their operating funds from the state. I think we all recognize that community colleges aren't an island unto themselves. In fact, there are dozens of faculty who teach courses such as Writing 121 at both our community colleges and our OUS campuses. The difference is at OUS campuses, they are able to qualify for partial retirement benefits if they teach better than half-time. Senate Bill 1021 is an attempt at correcting an error by establishing a fair standard for community college part-time faculty so they are able to receive the partial or prorated benefits under OPSERP that the legislature intended for them to receive. The idea behind the language in Senate Bill 1021, as well as the Dash 1 amendments, was to provide a simple calculation for determining benefits for part-time faculty. If a part-time faculty member teaches half-time or 24 credit hours, they should get a half year of credit toward their retirement plan. If they teach 32 credit hours, they should get three-quarters of a credit of the contribution. Now, the reason for the 48 credit hours base standard, it was an attempt to set the bar a little bit higher in order to account for the additional hours that full-time faculty have with committee assignments and other work-related functions not required of part-timers. You also may hear from the Community College Administration that this bill is too costly or that it brings too many people in. Our intention is not to extend benefits to a group of part-time faculty who are being denied benefits or who would have received benefits under PERS. We are not wedded to this formulation in this bill. However, we would like the opportunity to work with the community colleges to find a statewide solution and a fix this legislative session. AFT Oregon stands arm-in-arm with community colleges when it comes to funding our vital programs at our community colleges. And the fact that the general fund support has dropped over $70 million in the last 5 years hasn't helped. However, it does not excuse abusing the legislature's intent by denying community college faculty access to retirement benefits they rightly deserve. We do stand ready and willing to work with community colleges to correct this issue and establish a fair statewide standard for OPSERP eligibility for part-time faculty.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Mr. Fulbright.
Hi, members of the committee. My name is Ross Fulbright. I've been a part-time instructor at Portland Community College since January of 2003. As a part-timer, I teach an average of 10 courses a year, including summers, for a total of 37 to 42 credits per year. I attend many of the same meetings as the full-timers and volunteer for committees and events along with other part and full-time faculty. It is my understanding that under the current interpretation of the rules, I would not be eligible for PERS if I was hired after August 30th of 2003. I know of several part-timers who are working the same load as myself and were hired after after that date of August 30th, 2003. The reason I think part-timers is somewhat of a misnomer is that my wife is a full-time faculty also at Portland Community College. Last year, I taught more credits than she did. I taught 41 credits. She taught 39. I had more contact hours in class than she did, including what she did in the three quarters. Mine was the four. Under this ruling in terms of the 600 hours, my wife, or actually no full-time faculty of PCC, if they were held to the same standard, would actually qualify for PERS. To say that we only teach in class is similar to saying that you guys only work when you're in committee here. And my guess is that this is just a small fraction of the effort you put in for us. In the past, I understand that full-time employees that we are not obligated to be doing the extra work that many of us do in terms of volunteering, in terms of advising, in terms of all these other issues. In the past, PCC has understood that we put in 89% as full time that compensates for the extra work that they're required to do. Even though many of us volunteer and do this anyways on our own because of our concerns for the school. So, in essence, the reason I'm comparing my wife is that two out of three quarters, I have at least the same number of contact hours and credit hours as she does every year. Yet I get no benefits and, of course, have to pay. You were asking a little bit about the pay scale. My wife, during the three-quarter term, I believe is at $43,000. I think I made 23 last year. She, of course, gets all the benefits, which adds, you know, a lot of value to that, added value to that.
And do you know, Mr. Fulbrook, what the percentage of part-time faculty is to full-time faculty?
3-1.
Part-time is 3-1?
There are 500 full-time faculty. Is my understanding.
Yeah, that's about right.
There's about 500 full-time faculty at Portland Community College. There are 1,500 part-time faculty.
Thank you.
And I
don't ask that question to beat up on community colleges because I'm very aware, as Mr. Wagner pointed out, what the state has done in terms of funding for community colleges. I just think it's a sad statement in terms of what's happened to our community college system, which is such a vital part for education and for economic development. So
exactly. Yeah, I mean, I was a part-timer at Portland State as well.
So.
And yeah, I know the drill. I think it's important to realize that what we do for out of passion. I mean, we realize that we're not making the money, and we've accepted that. I've given up. I was a contractor and made three times the salary that I currently make. However, I just enjoy going to work so much that's worth it for me. And because we have such a passion, I mean, we are actively involved. We, just by the fact that there are three times as many part-time employees of teaching as there are full-time, shows that we are not technically temporary status as the college would like to have you believe. I mean, they could not function or operate without us. And we understand that financially they couldn't function or operate without us. But when you think of part-time, you think of temporary. This is not a seasonal issue. Many of us have been there for years or even decades as a part-timer. Many people will spend their entire career as a part-timer, working basically a full-time load, but as a part-timer. And again, they're doing this out of a passion for it. And the colleges traditionally, in my mind, have taken advantage of that in terms of the fact that we're willing to do it. It fills a need. And obviously, it does make a huge financial difference for them. But because we're willing to dedicate so much of our time and our lives for this, I think it's only fair that we deserve to have some sort of compensation toward retirement. I mean, if you spend 10, 15 years as a part-timer working side by side with a full-timer in the same exact load, you should have some sort of acknowledgement for that dedication and for that service. And as we all know, the colleges would not be able to function without us doing what we do and having the dedication that we do. I mean, even though most of us, they say that the extra work is just voluntary, we do that. As far as the contact hours versus the total hours, as Senator Brown is well aware, that a small percentage of that time is actually in class. I would estimate that comfortably we probably spend 2 hours outside of class for every hour inside of class.
Mr. Folberg, I've got 4 other people that need to testify. I have 15 minutes, so
okay.
If you could wrap it up, that'd be great. And I need to introduce some students that are here today.
Okay, I would just like to ask that we are shown the same sort of dedication and commitment that we show to colleges and to the communities and to our students.
Okay.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fogler. I understand that the class needs to leave at this point, but I did want to recognize Ms. Kristen Heckelman and her students. Ms. Heckelman, do you want to introduce the school for us?
Yes, we are the high school from Germany, and these are all juniors. And we have here in Salem.
Thank you very much.
We're delighted to have you here today, and I wish my German was any good, but I can't speak anything in German. So. Thank you. So. Have a safe trip back home. Wish you'd gotten some more warm Oregon weather. Willkommen. I'm not going to try that one.
Can I make one more comment?
Sure, if it's brief.
Okay. Regarding the idea that the colleges can't equate the hours that we work outside of class and inside of class, I would make an argument that this is somewhat absurd, because by the very definition of FTE, this is exactly what FTE is all about and exactly what it is doing. FTE essentially is equating a certain amount of contact hours with full time. So in some sense, by the college is saying they can't, you know, equate that. I mean, that's entirely what FTE is exactly that equation. And last year I would have had 2.79 FTE, where a full-timer is 3 FTE.
Thank you. Ms. Pitts.
Good morning, Chair Brown and Senator Ferrioli. I have some brief comments, very brief comments myself, and then I've brought some also fairly brief comments from a part-time instructor. I'll go through mine and then go through hers. My name is Marilyn Pitts, and I'm president of the Part-Time Faculty Association at Mount Hood Community College. I represent approximately 450 instructors and tutors within that group. Since 1972, I've been an instructor in Oregon, first at the high school level, teaching social studies for 18 years. Since 1991, I've taught at either or both Mount Hood Community College and Portland Community College, currently only at Mount Hood. A couple of years ago, and I think this is important to just mention briefly, I qualified for PERS. I am retired. So I mention that because the bills that I'm going to comment about do not, for the most part, affect me. But clearly, they are affecting the part-time faculty and tutors who I represent. The bills today, as you've clearly already heard, have some flaws, or you might call them oversights, that were not addressed when they were being created. I personally have been contacted by several part-time faculty who've discovered the challenges in even qualifying for PERS or the counting of the 600 hours. I am here in support of, and you can see the bills I've listed. Based on the previous comments, I want to just make a mention about a break in service in 1019. Let's see. As far as part-time faculty go, I know of an individual who contacted me just 2 days ago who had made himself available to teach, which is what we all do. He had received class assignments 2 different terms. In the current economy, classes are being cut for low enrollment. His classes were cut, and, you know, he would be out of it because that would have put him into the 6-month region. I have some specific comments about Senate Bill 1021. It's already been alluded to, the 600 hours has already been alluded to. I think that that literal requirement may be reasonable in some work situations, but as you've already heard, it doesn't acknowledge the fact that part-time faculty do a great deal outside the classroom. As you're, I think, also aware, each community college determines how it will convert classes that are taught into hours. Some are just counting the class meeting times. Others are actually incorporating a little bit of the work done outside of the classroom. Mount Hood is actually doing that. As a result, and I think this is important, part-time faculty across the state are being treated differently, even though it's a statewide benefit. Senate Bill 1021 provides a formula. It makes sense. We'd be treated the same. I support that. One group of part-time faculty who are not addressed in 1021 are part-time faculty who teach non-credit classes and are paid on an hourly basis. They, too, do much outside of class, and they are... I'm well aware at Mount Hood their FTE is determined quarterly, so it has been identified, but somehow they need to be factored into this formula. As it has been mentioned at PCC and definitely at Mount Hood, the full-time load is actually 45 credits. Definitely in the spirit of compromise, and I think any good bill probably has compromise on both sides, we are certainly willing to accept the 48 in Senate Bill 1021. We think it's a reasonable way to compute the retirement credits for part-time faculty, and we ask for your support. Those are my comments.
Great.
I do have comments now from Gay Monteverde.
I think we have a copy of those. I will submit them for the record, and I appreciate you providing those for us.
And you'd rather I didn't mention anything?
That'd be great. Okay. We are out of time, basically.
Yep.
So thank you.
You bet.
Thank you.
May I just mention, we also have another community college instructor, Paul Fisher. He's on the list. If you'd like, he's available to come right up so that you're getting all that message at once,
okay,
or later is fine.
He can come on up with Jesse Villarreal and Lori Sattensfield. Sorry, I didn't see that name. So.
Thank you.
Yes. If we have exactly 10 minutes.
Oh, that's fine. Hi, Chair Brown, members of the committee, Lori Sattensfield, Oregon Community College Association. I've got a couple of letters from one of our colleges who have a break in service that impacts them, and we are very supportive of the coalition and the impact that has on break in service, and are working with the group to come to resolution, and we're very much supportive of that. Specifically, I'd just like to touch on Senate Bill 1021 and how the PERS part-time issue, our colleges amongst themselves are having problems. We sent out for some information back on how it's calculated. We're all over the board because each college does it differently. It's based on workload. Mr. Wagner referenced clock hours and student FTE. That is, I believe, that's how we fund our the college itself on the funding formula. So we may want to look at that. That's not how these hours are calculated. When this bill began to come into effect, we had to talk with PERS. We did realize we didn't know how this affected us. PERS gave us instruction to actually ask us to tell them how we were going to calculate for PERS to work with. As you heard previously as well, concerns of our college, this bill does not factor in non-credit courses and how are those to be determined. And just want to let you know we are working with the proponents of the bill to try to come to a resolution. And thank you for your time.
Thank you. We appreciate that.
Why don't you go next?
I will. Good morning. My name is Jesse Villarreal from PERS Help, and I appreciate the time this morning, Madam Chairwoman and committee member Ferrari. I started PERS Help 3 years ago as a resource for PERS members to receive unbiased education and information regarding this complex plan that we're all involved in. My father was a member and a very smart guy, and nobody could ever make heads or tails of what was going on. I'm here in opposition to Senate Bill 1020. Senate Bill 1020 essentially is a license to double dip. It's a license to keep costs artificially high and force or coerce members into receiving their service retirement allowance and regular earned income at the same time. That means their taxes go up, penalties are induced onto their Social Security income, everybody is hurt. There are many methods in which to bring the retired member back and cut 33.89% of PERS-related costs by simply removing the member out of the system. Everybody benefits. If you do that, members would be able to receive raises that they're entitled to, other benefits including health care. There's millions, literally hundreds of millions of dollars that would be freed up each year if members were allowed to not stay in the system once they were retired and brought back. Senate Bill 1020 adds to the complexity of PERS and keeps members confused while prohibiting them from protecting their life savings. Senate Bill 1020 takes money away from children, education, school, social services, and health care. I have been representing thousands, literally thousands of teachers and other workers across the state that are PERS members for the last 3 years, traveling on my own dime. I continue to hear from members and now representatives and other senators that why isn't this method allowed? Senate Bill 1020, again, forces the cost to stay up artificially. It's an unproductive, outdated, and expensive method in which to coerce members into keeping the state keeps their life savings. I continue to believe that focus should be on reducing PERS cost while also increasing PERS benefits to its members and letting the member protect their life savings. We've done an extensive amount of work on this. We've literally heard from thousands. Our busiest month ever, we had 172,000 hits to our website, and we are hearing from members across the state that they should not be coerced into giving up their life savings in order to be rehired. It drops the cost dramatically. If they're able to retire, come back as a non-PERS member, everybody wins. Everybody.
Thank you. So. Appreciate your comments.
My name is Paul Fisher. I'm from Rogue Community College in Medford and Grants Pass. I've submitted some written comments that I won't review now. I'd like to leave you with two stories of part-time employees that we have that are long-term top part-time employees and very valuable to our college. The first one is a person from India, and she teaches a number of writing courses, and she teaches enough to just make her Tier 2 PERS eligibility. A year ago last spring, she left to return to India to attend the wedding of her niece. It was, she had to take the entire quarter off, and so what that did was effectively it dropped her below the eligibility rate that we are calculating. And so as the grievance chair, my position was that I had to explain to her how come her retirement was affected so negatively because she attended the wedding of her niece. Another employee that I have is a math instructor, again, a long-term math instructor, and the way we calculate PERS and the method, there's a disconnect because most colleges work on a fiscal period from July 1 to June 30th, and the PERS works on a calendar basis. Mm-hmm. And so the calculation and the schedules and a person's work is based on a fiscal calendar, and yet we have to calculate the PERS on a calendar basis. And what happened to this gentleman was that we did not realize that he was eligible for PERS until the last 2 months, and there's an additional 6% that needs to be taken out of his check. And so the last 2 months of the year, November and December, the part-time employee's check was substantially reduced in order to pay the 6% of his total yearly wages. And it's those kinds of disconnects that make it real difficult to work. It, both the college ends up looking bad, and we end up looking bad as representatives of faculty. So when you look at changing the system and changing the rules, it would be very good to look at how they're implemented on the ground, and some statewide ground rules would be very advantageous.
Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you very much. Appreciate you traveling such a long distance to join us this morning. Thanks to all of you. And unless there's anyone in the audience that absolutely must testify, I'm not seeing any hands. We're going to adjourn the committee at this time. We'd certainly ask the work group to get together as quickly as possible to deal with the Senate bills where there's still some issues. We look forward to hearing from you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. Here's that. Thanks.
You're welcome.